Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here with you as always. Kevin, I've heard that you're not feeling quite up to snuff. I'm so sorry to hear that.
I'm not up to snuff. I would feel much better if I was at that level. And I'm not sure snuff is a real high level.
I don't know. I may have just made that up. And
no, it's a term, but I don't know what it means.
I always thought it meant like you're not up to par, you're not on my level. But I guess we could apply it to health. It's my podcast. I'll do what I want.
If you can do what you want. No, it's I had a deadline on Monday to, you know, I had a headline to build a high tunnel, and because we had a USDA grant, and our local USDA agent said, well, you're at the use it or lose it point, because we, you know, had to have it up in order to actually get the money, and it was allocated but not, you know, delivered, and I already paid out of pocket for it. So she said, we're at the use it or lose it point. We need to have it done pretty soon. And I said, okay, well, what's that, like November? And she goes, no, 2 weeks. And so this is a gigantic 100 foot by 30 foot high tunnel, which is like a 5-person job over, you know, course of a week. And it turned into a 1, maybe 2-person job over one solid week. And I put the last screw in as she pulled up. and then after we went and got barbecue, and then I started running a fever. So for 4.5 days now, I've just been sick. It's like I was playing through it, and it was stewing in me waiting to get that thing approved. But it's been bad. It's not COVID. I've tested twice, not COVID. I've had a strange craving for bananas. I'm throwing poo at people. I don't know if those are symptoms consistent with any known disease, but
I think you're talking about I don't know what you're talking about. Can anyone clue me in? There's got to be some disease, but like maybe the name gives you a clue to the joke that Kevin just made. I'm kidding. All right, let's get into some science. Three really cool stories. First up, dark personalities. When are destructive traits like narcissism and psychopathy most likely to appear? Next, what's in our genes that explains why some lifelong smokers never get cancer? And finally, toxic fruits and vegetables? Inspired by EWG's chemical scare fundraising gimmick in the U.S., Pesticide Action Network brings disinformation to Europe. All good stuff. Kevin, what are we talking about? Dark personalities.
Well, this is kind of a synthesis of a rather simple study that was done. It was published in, well, I don't remember where it was published. Anyway, it was published in, here it was, I'm sorry. You know, preparation, man, the Journal of Research and Personality. And it was a breakdown and a synopsis of this particular study by Theo Klimstra, who was the lead author on the study. And they looked at what were called traits of the dark triad. And the dark triad is this very well-known set of clear personality traits of narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism. Easy for me to say. Machiavellianism is, it's a trait where you have people who have a certain bravado that allows them to be ultra manipulative, and really it's associated with gaining power. So it's this using manipulation to get power and at any cost, that kind of personality trait. So looking at that combination is what they refer to as the dark triad. And over the years, it's become increasingly more prevalent in the psychology literature because it's been associated with so many of the behaviors that we've seen online, and that many of the folks who take aggressive stances online are really part of the dark triad. or possess traits of the dark triad. And really what it comes down to is this, they wanted to study when this emerges, you know, when are these traits most likely there? So they studied 4,000 Dutch people, which we'll see later may not have been the best set to test, because the Dutch kind of seem, it'd be like doing 4,000 Canadians, you know, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of this out there, but you know, that of course is just my guess. So they actually did the experiment. They had people do a questionnaire and they rated themselves 1 through 9 for specific kinds of traits. And in the paper that goes along with it, they actually refer to it as the Dirty Dozen. There's different kinds of ways of assessing things like egocentricity and callousness and, you know, being insensitive towards others. And people, and you can assess this inside a questionnaire by ranking how you are in these areas from 1 to 9. And the funny thing about this kind of personality trait in the dark triad is that people who have these traits are very happy to admit they have them. Cause like you would start to think like, well, why would someone put down that they're, you know, a very cunning psychopathic callous jerk, you know, but people who are that way are very happy to self-describe that way. So these tests seem to be pretty valid. And when they did this across a number of age groups. And what they found was that the highest average was somewhere in the age group of college age young adults, that area there. And that the lowest assessments like this were in children. And so the basic idea was, and even that level was a 5 out of 9. So it wasn't a real high level, but they said, you know, 5 out of 9. Now, of course, that doesn't have a statistical breakdown. And so as the authors mentioned, that showed a very wide distribution. So there is a 5 all 5s, or is a 5 half 1s and half 9s, right? Both average 5. So what they wanted to do is look at that. Turns out that you get the widest distribution with the most extreme high cases of dark triad in that college age young adult group. And so it appears that this kind of starts to turn on about then, and that's kind of when we're at our peak for these kinds of behaviors. And when you think about it and you look at people you know, people you've known in your life, people you know see online, that's kind of about where that window probably is.
This just occurred to me, but it sounds like you're saying it's people of college and university age who are most likely to display these traits. Do I have that right?
Well, that's what the study showed, was that they were the ones that self-assessed to have the highest level of these personality traits.
I gotcha. Yeah, I see things. I just in the news, or you see something on TV or whatever, and assuming these results are valid, and I wanted to get into that next, but this might help explain, you know, some of the behavior that you see. But in any event, I'm wondering how much stock you put in self-report studies like this, because in the world of epidemiology, I think even on this show, we've been pretty critical of research that's based on that sort of data, because people lie or forget all sorts of information, right? They lie about going to church, how much they eat, how much they drink, how much they smoke, how they vote, do they vote? Like all of these questions, it's been pretty well documented that people won't tell you the truth, or sometimes they forget. So I'm wondering in this case, how confident are you in these sort of results?
Well, that's one of the things the authors emphasized. And I mentioned this briefly, but it was that people who have these traits are happy to tell you they have these traits and that there does seem to be a very strong correlation between the actual behavior and what's self-reported. So it'd be like asking, you know, folks who are proud of chain smoking, how much they smoke, they would tell you exactly where they're at. These folks, because of these behaviors being part of a bravado and a certain kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Egocentricity. They're very happy to report those tendencies.
Yeah, I saw that. And I also saw in the Psychology Today article, which is what we were talking about originally, by the way, for you folks out there, they also said that they couldn't administer as detailed of a questionnaire as they wanted because the people with these traits would be unlikely to complete it.
That's true.
So,
yeah.
So I'm wondering how you balance this. They're saying we couldn't do the personality inventory or whatever that we wanted to do because they wouldn't answer, they wouldn't fill it out. But I guess the ones that showed up are happy to talk as much as you want about it. I don't mean this as a dig at the researchers, because studying people is very difficult because you can't put them under a microscope and, you know, do all the sorts of experimental stuff that you do with things in nature, you know, cells and trees and blah, 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 whatever, you know, but I'm starting to understand after reading this paper and others like it, why psychology gets so much criticism from people in the natural sciences is because there's just an inevitable sort of softness in the methodology that you can't help. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. But this is why the authors go as far as they do to discuss the limitations of the experiment. And good authors will do that. They'll say, you know, here are the limitations. We talked just to Dutch people. You know, this may be very different somewhere else. Limitations of 4,000 people that when you break it down into the different ages may not be as representative as we like. And, you know, if with a more rare set of personality disorders, you may need a higher power study to be able to capture them. The degree of the questionnaire that's used, you know, the extensiveness of it, you know, so these are all limitations that the authors are happy to talk about, and good authors will discuss their limitations in their manuscript always.
Sure. It's tough stuff. And it's the reason I thought of that is because I read a lot about economics, and that field deals with the same thing there. You know, you have people who they really love econometric models and statistics, and they think you can, you know, study people's behavior that way. And then you have others who say, well, that methodology is just dumb because these are humans. Like, they live and breathe and they move around and their motivations are different. So it's an interesting question. And again, not slamming them. I thought it was a reasonably well-designed study for what they were doing.
What did you think about their synthesis? Like, you know, why that age group would be the worst with these kinds of traits, or I shouldn't say the worst, I'm putting a qualifier on it. The most likely to exhibit these behaviors.
Again, this is, I think, where one of the inherent weaknesses is in just studying human behavior. So they speculated, if I remember the paper correctly, they said that, you know, over an evolutionary timescale, there may be some fitness benefit to, you know, being a narcissist or being a psychopath. And so, you know, these things are conserved over time. So I think that was one of the explanations. I suppose there's some truth to that. At least theoretically, it makes sense to me, but I don't know how you would demonstrate that scientifically. You know what I'm saying? So it's a plausible explanation. I just don't know how it could be borne out by actual evidence.
That's all speculation. And they just say, so they just say, you know, why would this be? Well, maybe it's cause, you know, you're better at finding a partner. You know, if you had these kinds of, you know, I guess it doesn't sound like that would work.
Gosh, right.
Such a jerk. I gotta get with him.
Well, I'm willing to club the other guy in the face. And so there's fewer options. So, you know, like,
yeah. But if you look across the political landscape, you look across, you know, corporate landscape, you know, there's a lot of people who are real jerks who, you know, the Gordon Geckos of the world who, ascend to power or to positions of power by really, not necessarily, promoting self, but by crushing others. And those kinds of behaviors are still alive and well today. And that's, and that was really what they suggested was, you know, is this about competition for position or status, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, that's a good, good speculation.
Yeah. And I don't mean a lot of people will dismiss evolutionary psychology as it's a field of just so stories. I don't think that's true. I think for some personality traits, especially when you look at it across the gender divide, there's ways to suss out the evolutionary origins of some of these things. I just think that in some cases, we've talked about this at least once before on this show, in some cases you can posit an explanation. You can go, well, people love gold as a money because it glitters. And when our ancestors were looking for water, that glittered too. And so, you know, we developed this interest in gold. From like something like that is just you know, you're writing fiction at this point. It's not, there's no science there. That's all I was getting at.
Yeah. All good.
Oh, okay. So again, not swinging at the authors. I just want to make that clear. But let's move on, Kevin. I thought this was, as a former smoker, this next story really caught my attention. So what are we talking about here?
Well, it's a good question. And it was really about why lifelong smokers never get lung cancer. And this was by Mary Casella. And this was first published in Science Alert and later at the Genetic Literacy Project. And what she talked about was that we know the number one risk factor for smoking is is having lungs. Now, the number one risk factor for lung cancer is smoking. And when you look at 90% of the lung cancer deaths that are out there, they are due to or can be narrowed down to smoke. And this is and people would say, well, how do you know that? Well, there are specific mutations that are known to be induced by tobacco smoke that you can actually test for. And you can test for that mutation in the tumor, and you can say this was a smoker's tumor. I mean, it's that good. I mean, of course, it's not every smoking cancer, but there's quite a few that you can nail down to the mutation. And what they found was, and the way that they did this experiment, this was a paper in Nature Genetics, they did an experiment where they harvested cells from a rather small group of people. Okay, it wasn't a big extensive study, but 14 never smokers, 19 light, moderate, and heavy smokers, and they ran those cells through DNA sequencing. And what you could look for are variations in between those groups that occur because of a couple different reasons. One is what's just the natural variation that's occurring, you know, between one person and another, but are there variants that are occurring because of the degree of smoking? Okay. So do you see predictable changes that are occurring in smokers' lungs? And what they found is that you do, you find that there are specific changes that occur in DNA in the bronchi that occur with age and then other ones that occur with smoke. And the DNA changes are extremely significant. And what they find out is that if you look at the number of mutations, they do increase as smoking increases. But when you have the most smokers, or the heaviest smokers, they didn't have the highest mutations. And that was the real strange thing here, is that there seems to be a protective effect of smoking. No, what it says is that there are some people who can smoke as much as they want and they don't get these genetic changes. And what it boils down to most likely is DNA repair. And that DNA repair is extremely active in these individuals and it's able to correct the mutations as they happen.
Super cool study. I could see the update on our SourceWatch pages right now. Cameron and Kevin deny the link between smoking and lung cancer. And then they link to this episode that no one would actually listen to. I think that'd be hilarious if they did that. In all seriousness, though, since I'm being nitpicky about study designs, what do you think about this one as a geneticist? This seems to me, you're the geneticist, not me. Sorry for people out there. As a layperson, this study design seems pretty robust to me. It seems like it's going to reveal useful information. What's your take on that?
No, I think I agree. I think you can see specific, if you're talking about specific changes that are linked to the treatment to smoke, and they're doing this in a dose dependent way, you'd be able to see trends between groups and across groups. And the other nice thing about this is that you're really doing 19 different experimental replicates and within then technical replicates within. So you're able to look at 19 different people. So that's pretty powerful stuff, especially for this type of sequencing analysis. And if the place where it would start to fall apart is that if these changes were relatively rare and you would need to have, say, 100 people to detect 10 rather than 19 people to detect one, you know, that wouldn't tell you anything. But I think that's the beauty of this, is that the reproducibility of these specific mutations associated with DNA repair, or that indicate a difference in DNA repair, are something consistent between smokers. And we've known for a long time that there are specific genes. Some of the ones, like one of the big ones, is one called P53. It was the 1993 molecule of the year. P53.
There's molecules of the year. I didn't know
that. Yeah, Science magazine has a molecule of the year. It's kind of like their swimsuit edition. You know, everybody goes and gets that one. So you get the molecule of the year, and then you read the molecule of the year. So it was P53, which at the time, 1993, it's almost 30 years ago, that molecule was thought to be it is a very potent tumor suppressor. It's got a great story behind it. We'll talk about someday, but P53, is deficient in many different smoking tumors. And so it actually releases cells from some of the factors that restrict proliferation. And a number of mutations either affect the expression of P53 or P53 itself. And that's why some of these are really easy to link directly to smoking.
That's so fascinating. Why do you think a study like this was just done recently? Because we've long suspected that this is some kind of effect like this is real, because I think it's really low. It's like 10% of smokers actually get lung cancer. There's lots of other diseases that will kill you. Don't get me wrong. So smoking's very, very dangerous. But I'm wondering, is it just expense, or is it trying to come up with the right design? What would prevent us, or what would prevent scientists from doing a study like this, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago?
I don't know. I think right now it's really just the ability to do high throughput sequencing from a relatively small amount of cells, because you have to get some, you know, bronchial cells out of, you know, 19 different people and be able to get what we refer to as representation. You may have mutations in different cells. You're collecting a population of cells that are accumulating populations to be able to, or accumulating mutations. To be able to get representative mutations, you need to get out of a small number of cells, you probably have to do some very, what we would say, deep sequencing, lots of sequencing reads. Essentially, what we do is when we sequence a genome is we sequence little islands of it, little pieces, and then we put all the pieces together by overlapping them. And so, you know, it's like if I gave you A, B, C, D, and then I gave you C, D, E, F, G, H, and then I gave you F, G, H, I, J. You could put those three fragments together and get the first part of the alphabet. And that's how you do it with DNA sequencing. It's just overlapping these little fragments. And nowadays, the sequencing technologies are so good, and the number of letters you get is longer, and it's so cheap that you can get jillions of those little fragments. So it just makes this kind of thing feasible.
I got it. Makes perfect sense. As we wrap up and move on to the next story, I just love research like this because it reminds me of why it's so important to actually do science. Because I know we've suspected this for a long time, but this really upends a lot of people's expectations, I think. And like in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of research that which seems to suggest, we're not really sure why or even if this is correct, but it seems that smokers seem to have some sort of protection against COVID, which is not what you would expect, right? You're chronically damaging your lungs with cigarettes and you have protection against a respiratory infection. That sounds absurd, right? But, you know, that's why we do studies like this, I guess. I just find that pretty cool.
Yeah, it's neat. But it does reaffirm that smoking is a risk factor. And we also reaffirms, we know exactly how it affects and connects to cancer. So that's really a good finding.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't smoke. If that wasn't clear before, don't smoke. It's not good for you. Okay. Kevin, this is your story, and it was a very good one, if I might say so myself. You're a talented writer, my friend.
Well, that's nice to hear. Thank you. This was a really fun story because I couldn't believe what I was reading when I was reading an article online about the Pesticide Action Network Europe. And Pesticide Action Network published a report that basically said all your food is poison. They published this thing called forbidden fruit. And if you want to read it, go ahead and Google it. And what they do is they do the same thing the Environmental Working Group does with the Dirty Dozen, is they tear the page right out of their book. Is they went and looked at government data that the government data that assessed pesticide residues on fruits and vegetables and said, it's safe. You know, look, here's the levels that we detected. These are safe. What the Pesticide Action Network did was they went and said, wait a minute, but it's detected. It's not zero. So since it's not zero, it's there. And if it's there, it's poison. And so we don't care how much it is. Do you want to feed that to your family? And they built these claims about how the residues are increasing over time. So even though they really just took government data that said, you know, safety regulatory data that say it's fine, they created an extensive, shiny, slick narrative saying that your food is poison. And so the big problem with this is this. When they put this out there, the media eats it up. They don't ask, does the dose make the poison? They say, oh, look it, our food is awful. Everything's screwed up. And when you look at the headlines that came out that day, there were the Pesticide Action Network, they just put out there, we've detected more pesticides on food than before. What they're saying is more different kinds of residues that are almost there. I mean, almost not there. Very, very low levels. But they were detected. And that's because we're really good at detecting things. We can detect these different pesticides at the levels of parts per billion, parts per trillion. So we're talking about, you know, a second in 32 years. That low we can detect. I mean, that's how great this technology is. But when you give that second in 32 years to someone who hates chemistry or, you know, hates agriculture, they say, well, wait a minute, that's 1 second too many. Can't do that. And so that's the basis of this problem.
This just occurred to me, but there's a, I believe he's a soil chemist. I think that's his expertise. His name's Trevor Charles. He's at the University of Waterloo in Canada, I think.
Yeah, Trevor's awesome.
Trevor's the man. I'm going to get a shirt that says I heart Trevor Charles because he does really good work. You can follow him on Twitter. That's what I'm getting at. He's not my follow, but he talks a lot about this and he's really good at explaining what is really technical science in terms that dumb guys like me can understand. And it's just so helpful to sort of have those people on your Twitter speed dial, if you will, because you can go compare what you read to what folks like he say. It's just really helpful. But a couple of things just based on your initial comments, Kevin. Detecting something, it sounds scary, but when you think about it, it's not the big of a deal. You know, like I could say there's highly toxic chemicals just 5 feet away from where my baby sleeps at night. Now, in reality, there's a house between him and the chemicals are used by a licensed professional to kill the bugs so they don't get in my house, right? No one freaks out about that, but if you were to measure, you know, conduct some kind of a test, you'd probably find some insecticide around the border of my property, and no one freaks out about that. And the same thing we've talked about before, like there are literally lines in a lot of houses that run flammable gas through your house. You know, can you imagine explaining that to someone 200 years ago? Like what insanity are you? You have flammable gas in your house? Are you stupid? You know? So just detecting something, it doesn't give you the necessary context. And so that's one thing. But the thing with the media, this drives me bonkers, man, because the conversation, popular science, Scientific American, of course, CNN, ABC, all of them do this, and especially the science media, they really should know better because they get up on their soapbox and they lecture everyone about misinformation and, you know, follow the science. And then they publish stories like this, or they talk about glyphosate and they interview someone like Charles Benbrook, who's a consultant for the organic industry, or they cite the IARC monograph uncritically and they don't tell their readers anything about what experts say about IARC's review. Namely that it's garbage. And it boggles my mind that happens. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the part where it really breaks bad. Let me come back to that in a second. I wanted to touch on something on quantitation because that's one of my favorite lines out of this is it's akin to someone taking a eyedropper of crude oil and placing a drop in the ocean in Iceland and reporting that penguins will be coated with sludge in Antarctica. After all, there's oil in the water. Drop of oil equals Exxon Valdez. Same. Because that's really what this is. I thought that was such a good analogy. But throughout this entire piece, throughout the entire report that they gave, Forbidden Fruit, they used the word contaminated. Okay, so it's contaminated with 19 chemicals, none of which are within 10,000 times any kind of physiological relevance. They leave that out, but it's contaminated. And this is really has a important point. The part about the media is a big deal because they misinterpret what the report says. They don't critically understand what it says. The one was really important from Daily News Hungary, which I read every day. It says pesticide levels in Hungarian and EU fruits rise drastically. And you see the issue here. The levels didn't rise. The levels didn't rise at all. But so the Pesticide Action Network just puts out this thing that it can be easily misinterpreted and then allows the media to do the misinterpretation. So they're kind of the stooges for this Pesticide Action Network. Pesticide Action Network Europe can kind of wave its hands in the air and say, look, we're not being disingenuous. We're just saying that the percentage of these things detected goes up over time. You know, that's, you know. But then they let the media really run with it. And if it bleeds, it leads, and that leads to a bigger problem.
Well, shame on all you guys, because that's just ridiculous, especially because, as I said, you've sort of set yourselves up as the fact checkers and the gatekeepers of truth. And then you fall for this, or you are a willing participant in perpetuating this. And that's, you know, I remind me to face push you if I ever meet you.
Well, and what's the harm, right? And what's who cares, right? It's because this affects the poorest people, the people who can't afford organic produce, the people who, which is what they all advocate for. They say, well, if you want to avoid this, just buy organic produce, in which place you'll find a whole bunch of different chemicals that you can detect.
And we don't test apparently.
Yeah, that's true. So they don't tell you that, but this affects the poor. It affects the people who feel that they don't want to feed fruits and vegetables to their families because they're afraid of them, or, you know, I don't know, they opt for processed foods. That's been shown by the literature. So the healthiest things we can be eating, we need to be eating and celebrating the availability and access that we have to them at the amazing price they still are. And even though prices have gone up a little bit in fruits and vegetables, they're still very affordable for the amount of time and effort that goes into them, because the price is going up. Let me tell you for sure, the farmers aren't seeing any of that. And the farmers' costs for fuel and labor are going through the roof. So eat your fruits and vegetables, buy extra, go crazy, wash them before you use them, and enjoy them and be grateful that you have them, and tell people don't listen to these activist groups.
Totally. I will just say, as a new dad, this is a point I've made several times. This gets my blood boiling, because if you have kids, you know, if they're infants, if they're toddlers, if they're teenagers, whatever, you're always concerned for their welfare, and you're always concerned about threats that they're going to encounter out there in the world. And as a parent, you have to inform yourself and be able to make good judgments to protect your kids. Now, when that sort of risk assessment is going on in your head, and then you get groups like PAN polluting the conversation with this, it makes it difficult. Now, for me, because I do this for a living, it's not hard to look at what they're saying and go, pff. But for a lot of people, it's not like that, because they have other careers and they have other responsibilities. And so it's not just that this is wrong on an academic level. This is deceptive, and it's dangerous, and it makes it harder for people to make the judgments that they need to make to protect their families. It's just atrocious.
No, I agree 1,000%. Yep. That's why it's so sad that these groups receive grants, they receive money, they receive donations, when they are so deceptive. So that's really all I got to say about that thing. But just please eat your fruits and vegetables. Don't worry about it. Food is safe.
Yeah, man. Hey, one other pat on the back I want to give you, because you alluded to this, but you contrasted, you contrasted what the regulators do with what the activist groups do. So like here in the US, I'm more familiar with this process. The USDA goes around once a year, or they send people around, the Agricultural Marketing Service. They go to the various distribution points for fruit and vegetables in the states that produce all of our produce. And they actually measure the amount of pesticide residue, and then they compare it to safety standards that have been set by the EPA and that are periodically reviewed for each pesticide. And then they issue a report. You can read it for free. It's called the Pesticide Data Program. And it's really reassuring. And it's a very rigorous process. They explain where they got the samples, which samples they took, were they fresh, were they frozen, how much of each chemical did they detect, how did they detect it. And they make all of this information available. And if you just contrast what they do with what these activist groups do, it's just stunning, because they're operating within boundaries, right? The results are based on objective standards. They're telling you what those are. Whereas the activist groups go, as you said, oh, we found this insecticide. We don't know. It could be an endocrine disruptor. And then they just kind of throw that out there, and then you're left to figure it out. So just another contrast. Thank you for pointing that out. I thought that was an excellent observation. Way to go. Yeah,
well, and that could be a place where USDA and other agencies, FDA, EPA, could be better at countering this disinformation. Because if they really want to support American farmers, the USDA should come out with a counter to the Dirty Dozen every year. And rather than it just being a tagline on, you know, on the news report where they'll spend a minute on the Dirty Dozen and say at the end, the USDA says all your food is safe. You know, they need to really dig in and come out with a vicious thing, saying, here's what we measured and it's good. Everything's fine. And people will try to distort this data to fool you. You know, why am I and, you know, a handful of other idiots to people screaming about this? It should be from these agencies that are allegedly there to support farms.
Yeah, I've heard the excuse that I've heard from people at these agencies or affiliated with them is that, well, we don't get into politics. You know, that's a political dispute and we're objective regulators. We don't do that. You know, we're the philosopher kings that just out, you know, give information. Nonsense, because I've seen every one of these agencies at different points in time, and depending on the issue, get very political and make very, very incendiary and sometimes scientifically dubious statements because there's an incentive to do so for whatever reason. So the fact that they don't do it on this issue, that just like the media, it drives me nuts.
Yeah, well, they were great when mad cow disease came up. You know, when the cases of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, our federal agencies got very engaged in the public communication side and said, your beef is perfectly safe. It you know, that's, you know, 30 years ago, but there's a lot of great examples, like you say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll leave it there. Good job, Kevin. I know I keep patting you on the back this episode, but I was really happy with the story.
Yeah, stop it. It hurts.
Who are you following on Twitter this week?
I'm not used to pats on the back. You know, it's a weird thing for me. I'm following Jack Bobo, and I know I've recommended him before, but he's at Jack_A_Bobo, like B-O-B-O. And he always publishes some interesting stuff. He's got a great TED talk. He does some very nice work and has one of my favorite memes of all time. And so follow Jack. And what about you?
Well, my pick this week is inspired by a comment you made on our last episode. You said that all of the armchair virologists are now experts on Ukrainian history. And that's 100% true. And it made me laugh. So I'm going to recommend that people follow a website. They're called The Gray Zone, and they publish original journalism and really good analysis of different conflicts around the world, including what's going on in Ukraine. And they have real experts that write for them, like retired military generals and foreign policy analysts, like people you should listen to. And this is not science related, but, you know, it's in the news and all that. So go follow them. It's just at The Gray Zone, G-R-A-Y Zone. And learn from them, because we all do this. I'm guilty of this too. Like, whatever your political allegiances are, you start with what people on your side say about any topic, and then that sort of forms the foundation of how you understand that issue. And it's really dangerous to do that, and everyone's guilty. So try to break that habit and check out what the gray zone says about foreign policy stuff.
Cool.
All right, friends, thank you for joining us. Kevin, thank you as always.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm already looking forward to next week. You can follow us as well at Kevin Folta at ACSH.org for my writing. My website is CameronJEnglish.net. And follow GLP. They're on Twitter. They're just at Genetic Literacy, because they put this whole thing on, and we greatly appreciate
it. Yeah, we should mention that more often, I think, is that, you know, this wouldn't exist without the Genetic Literacy Project, and that the GLP, you know, allows us promotes this and really gives us this forum and gives people access to this. The reason this gets as many follows and as much action as it does is because of the conduit of GLP, which gets an awful lot of traffic every single day. So without them, we're, you know, just two other idiots talking in the microphones. So we are very grateful for the assistance they provide.
That was actually the alternative name for the show, was Two Idiots with Mics, but we went with Science Facts and Fallacies instead.
Better than Two Idiots in a Cup.
No. Why? Why did you have to mention that? Okay, guys, we will see you next week. Thank you very much.